gotta announce there's ice cream down there.
No, you should not. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, February 8th, 2016. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. And Mr. Borden, would you like to get us started, please?
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. Before you is the Public Employees Retirement System with a report on the assumed earnings rate. The 2015 legislature directed that the agency report, if it made any change to the assumed earnings rate, that change was approved by their board, and subsequently they are here to provide information on that update to the assumed earnings rate. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Rodham and Ms. Taylor, or whoever else is coming up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Roldman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employee Retirement System.
Linnea Whittakin with DAS Chief Financial Office.
And welcome, Linnea, Ms. Whittakin. It's nice to meet you. Hi.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Whoops.
It's okay. Don't worry about it. Go ahead.
Cool.
It's fine. We're just having some technical difficulties down here.
So we were directed, as LFO staff said, we were directed to return to you with a report on our activities related to the assumed interest rate. So just to set the background, we use the assumed rate at least three ways. The first, of course, is the discount rate for determining the current prospective assets and liabilities of the system, as we're directed to do under ORS 238-605. So that assessment means that we look at the system's prospective assets and liabilities as of the end of each calendar year, and those liabilities and assets are discounted back to a present value using that assumed rate. The other reason we have an assumed rate is as a component of our actuarial equivalency factor, or AEF, tables. When we're defining how long an account or how much of an account is used to fund a monthly benefit, we convert that pot of money into a stream of payments. That conversion uses two principal factors, one of which is mortality, how long that person is expected to live. The other is the assumed rate, how much will that pot of money earn during the payout period, so you know how much you need to make the payments last. And then lastly, because of the statute 238-255, the annual crediting rate for Tier 1 member regular accounts is guaranteed to be at the assumed rate. So we set the assumed rate using the investment direction that we get from the Oregon Investment Council, the OIC, and capital market expectations from our actuary, Milliman. The next slide.
Madam Chair.
Sorry,
thank you, Mr. Robin. The 0.25% reduction in assumed earnings turns out to be $1.7 billion in UAL.
It does.
So would that, is that a linear function? Would a 1% then be $6.8 billion?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it's pretty close to that. It is a pretty static change as far as this much down means this much of an increase in UAL.
So if you actually lowered it down to about 4%, it would add about some $24 billion to the UAL.
I'm relying on your math for that, sir. I can't do the math that quickly. But.
So then I'm confused. Decreasing the assumed rate? Oh, never mind. I get it now. Sorry. I got to answer my own question.
Okay. So the rate change that we did, we show you here on the slide the table that of investment return estimates that we used. This was a long conversation, meaning the Oregon Investment Council started the conversation by looking at their asset allocation model, and the OIC did that over a span of several meetings, finally landing in June at the OIC meeting on the allocation that they were going to move toward for the PERS fund. And with that allocation set at the June meeting, then the PERS board picked up that specific allocation in July and looked at these investment return assumptions. And out of this range of assumptions, they lowered the assumed rate from 7.75 down to 7.5, effective January 1, 2016. This was also effective for the 2015 valuation. Sorry to throw a lot of dates out at you, but the actual adoption of the assumed rate was for the actuaries to do their system valuation December 31, 2015. But because the assumed rate also affects rate crediting and actuarial tables, we delay the effect of that until January 1, 2016 to bring it into our operations. So that 7.5% assumed rate fits within the range and a narrow range of outcomes that Milliman expects. And so the top table here shows you the Milliman's capital market outlook, average annualized returns over the next 20 years. Milliman's outlook is a 6.99% at the 50th percentile, but they do stochastic modeling that shows a variety of expected returns. So you see, to get to the 7.5 that the OIC adopted and that their actuary Callan adopted, you don't have to go too far off of that 50th percentile to get to that 7.5% assumed rate. And then just to show you how we compare to other retirement systems, the table below that shows you that at a 7.5% return, we're pretty much in the middle, in fact, low in the middle for other retirement systems, according to the National Association of State Retirement Administrations, or NASR.
Senator Johnson.
How often is Milliman's contract refreshed? I believe that they're the actuarial firm for PERS as well. And I'm just wondering, when one actuarial firm gets itself embedded heavily in state government, do we ever have it peer reviewed? Do we ever refresh the contract? I know that they're not the only actuarial firm in the world. I'm just curious, given how much rests on their prognostications, whether or not you make any effort to test their accuracy or their nimbleness or their commitment to the state of Oregon.
Senator Steyer, here with Senator Johnson, we just went through the procurement for actuarial services last calendar year, and Milliman was selected. There were a couple of other actuarial firms that were considered. And so the answer is, in broad sense, we go through that procurement. I don't remember exactly, but it's at least every 5 or 6 years. In the balance in between that, we have actuarial audits where we have another actuary firm come in and review, in this case, Milliman's work, to do that assessment you're talking about, to make sure it is up to actuarial standards and up to industry standards. So that actuarial audit happens periodically kind of in between the procurements, so we make sure we stay on track.
I'm glad to hear that. I would be curious who the account executive is that services your agency, if it's different from PEB or if it's the same as PEB. I'm just trying to figure out if somebody drew the Oregon straw and they do everything out here, or whether or not you have a dedicated person in your shop doing this work.
Senator Steiner here with Senator Johnson. Our main service provider, if you will, for Milliman, his name is Matt Larrabee, and his focus is in retirement practice, so it is not the person who services PEB.
Thank you.
But he does service other retirement systems. He does Florida. He does the Portland Police and Fire.
That's fine. I just didn't want somebody holding the short straw that wrote Oregon on it, and we got one guy to do everything, so you've answered my question.
Thank you. So this chart shows you the effect of the assumed rate on one component of PERS dynamics, and that is our employer contribution rate. So what this chart shows you is what different linear outcomes of returns will do to the employer rates that we have. And you can see the first several biennia, starting in 1315, moving all the way out to 1921 pretty much, there's not a lot of dispersion based on the returns that we achieve, and that is because of all of the unfunded actuarial liability that is currently in the system. We have a rate collar policy that limits how much employer rates change from one biennium to the next, so it's going to take several biennia until the returns that we might get from our investment portfolio actually start spreading out those lines, and once we get past the rate collar. So just for illustration, if we hit the assumed rate, and that's that blue line at 7.5%, if we have a 7.5% rate of return, employer rates over the next 20 years or 10 biennia generally trend down, because OPSERP members are coming in to replace Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, and OPSERP members have generally a lower normal cost for their retirement benefits. If we hit the 7% rate of return, which is more in line with what Milliman estimated, then we still have a relatively flat projection for employer rates. If we can, for some good work on behalf of the OIC, actually return 10.5% on a flatline basis, you see that employer rates actually trend down to zero. And if, on the other hand, we have a long string of bad returns at 5%, employer rates top up there at 40. And this just shows you a dynamic as to how the assumed rate is a presumption we make in setting employer rates, but it's actual performance that's going to drive which of these lines we eventually end up on.
But there's one thing I don't understand from what you're saying, Mr. Redmond, or there's a lot of things, but this in particular. You said that at the current assumed rate of 7.5%, that they generally trend down over the next 20 years. But if I'm looking at the correct line, the blue line, even in 2033, which is almost 20 years from now, we're still well above the employer rates that we are in this biennium, right?
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. What I mean is once we get to the crest, of the rate collar, it doesn't matter what we return, it doesn't matter what we earn. For the next several biennia, we're all together.
Right.
Once we get out to 2021, 23, then whatever returns happened in that time and going forward actually creates some dispersion.
I think this is a really important point, and I think, frankly, everybody in the state should understand this, because this is exactly what we're having to deal with, and this is why our budgets are going to look so terrible for the next 3 or 4 biennia, well, really for the next 10 biennia, because our employer rates are going to go so high, and that's not going to buy us anything other than meeting our unfunded liability. It's not going to buy us teachers in the classroom or caseworkers for DHS or anything. It's only going to buy us filling our hole.
So Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, not to sound too pandering, but that's why I embarked on a 22-city tour around the state in the fall. In all of your individual districts, we had meetings with our employers to make sure they understood this dynamic and the causes of this dynamic, because you're right, it's not getting any better anytime really soon. So I thought part of that outreach would be my going out to employers and actually trying to get everybody with a common understanding of the drivers of this dynamic.
It's bad. Senator, what's it now?
I think you, and I appreciate that effort. There's actually several questions I have about that particular slide. Does that include the provisions of the 6% pickup, the cost of obligation bonds, and is the roughly 30% increase in public employees' wages over the next 4 years factored into that?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, this does not include the 6% IAP at all. This also does not include any effect of pension obligation bonds. What this does take into account is the fact that this is a rate, and the rate is on payroll. So it includes a projected growth in payroll that the rate would be subjected to over this period of time.
So it does include that 30% increase or so?
It includes a 3.5% per biennia, or sorry, per year increase in the payroll base. 3.5% per year is what the actuary understands.
Follow up?
Please.
LFO concurs with, I had calculated about a 40% increase, 30% increase over the next 4 years in salary. And their concurrence was, you're way low, Senator.
Wait. What did you say, Senator? 30% in
30%
4 years?
30% in the next 4 years of salary, yep.
Because 30%?
Because of the last labor negotiation.
Senator Steiner Hayward, if I may, Senator, what's that? You're talking about the state employee payroll roll up out of the unions, the union contracts. Our assumption is not at all related to that. First off, it's on the base of our public employees, which is much more broad than just the state. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we true up that assumption every 2 years when we do our experience study. So we haven't looked at that particular effect in our experience study because it hasn't happened yet in our experience, but we will when we do the next valuation, which closes December 31 of 2015.
That won't make it better.
Actually, it would make the rate lower because you're spreading it across a bigger base. If we increase our salary growth assumption,
isn't PERS a percentage of salary?
There are two components to our rate. One is what's called normal cost, and that is how much does the benefits that an individual earns. The other, what is now larger component, is unfunded actuarial liability. Mm-hmm. That's the number you're very familiar with. It is the money we owe for prior benefits. If you spread that UAL over a larger base, the rate of it is actually lower because you're paying for it. You're paying for a set dollar amount over a broader base. So if payroll grows more quickly, then the UAL rate goes down.
Percentage, the percentage goes down, the total amount goes up, yeah. And one other question, and that is on, if you were to add one more line on that and graph the 1.9% actual return that we had last year and graph that on into the future, and hopefully it gets a lot better than that, it wouldn't even be on the paper, would it?
Senator Stanley Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, we'd run out of the top probably at some point, but not until, again, several biennia down when we work our way through the rate collar, and hopefully by then we've had some good years to offset those bad years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Compton and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This topic is very sensitive to me. I'm retiring, and I have been very fortunate over my years as an educator to make some pretty wise and informed decisions. But what brought me to the legislature was the issue or the fact that every year as a school principal, my first call every year went to the business manager and said, well, how much is it going to cost me for every employee's salary? And every year it was higher. And I understand all that. And yet, what I don't know the answer. I think we need a lot more discussion on this. I don't know how much you're making on your investments, but it certainly are not those percentages. And beyond that, I don't see how a PERS is sustainable with the current trajectory we're on, much less one of the reasons, literally, that I'm retiring from the legislature is we're going to have such a hole in our budget next time. It is going to be an extremely, extremely difficult budget to deal with. And the only question I have, and it may be very premature, but has the PERS board thought about looking at and developing another tier?
Co-Chair Steiner here with Representative Comp. The answer to that is we have not, because it's the legislature that sets the benefits. The PERS board doesn't establish a new tier. We could certainly help any discussions you'd like to have around that, but I would go back to the point I made with Senator Whitsitt, that there are two components of any employer cost. One is normal cost, and the other is the unfunded liability. So every new employee that comes into PERS, their normal cost is, for general service people, meaning not police and fire, it's around 8%. So if you were to replace, let's say, PERS with another tier, mm-hmm. the only way you save money in a retirement system is you pay people less in benefits. It's the only way you save money. So how much further would you reduce the benefits from OPSERP? And if you even replaced it, let's say, with a defined contribution plan where you kicked in 6% of a member's salary, let's say, you're only shaving that difference between the normal cost and whatever the employer contribution into the DC is. So it's a conversation we're happy to have because we understand what a struggle this is going to be for the state. One of the reasons I did that tour that I did was to get employers to all understand where we're starting from. And I wish I had a good answer for you, but we'll talk through all the different options with the legislator and we have and will as far as what those dynamics might do. That's the best answer I have for you.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
I want to go back and tag onto the conversation that you had with Senator Whitsitt, and that is one of my great frustrations is to not see some of the prognostications in one place with all of the elements included, including the salary increases. And if the numbers that Senator Whitsitt has gotten from LFO are close to correct, I knew there was a train wreck. I didn't know that it was a catastrophic train wreck. And I think for the ability of the legislature to see all of this in one place not only gives us a sense of urgency about budget priorities, but it also, I think, would help to inform employers. Not that your tour wasn't informative and helpful, but so often in the legislature, there are little threads of a story in a whole lot of places. And unless you have the time and the patience and, frankly, the intellectual fortitude to knit them all together, it's very hard to see a global picture of what's happening. And I would almost plead with you to do some prognostications based on what we know could be operative facts over the next decade and share that with us. There are going to be payroll increases. There are going to be bond obligations. There are going to be all of these pieces. Get it in one place at one time so the legislature has the opportunity to see just how bad this is going to be.
Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, we hear that direction, and we will follow it as closely as we can. And the only equivocating I'm doing is, again, I have over 900 employers, and everyone's a snowflake. So if you want to have a conversation around the state's obligations, you know, we have a pretty clear picture of that. The state has a pension obligation bond. We can play that out for you. Schools, every school has their own individual financial situation, and the state picks up a big part of that. So we can probably show you a big part of the picture, but not all of the picture. And then local governments are all in different places. We can definitely, as Senator Whitsitt alluded to, talk about things like the rolling in the cost of the IAP, rolling in what we know about pension obligation bond costs, but those are, again, particular to every employer. So the data is all out there, and we can certainly do a better job of trying to show you a unified picture, and we'll work on that as we come back into the conversation.
I get that. Follow up, Madam Chair?
Sure.
I get that, and I understand it, and I'm sympathetic, and the way that you just articulated it was very helpful to me. But each one of your snowflakes, and I don't know to what degree you drove this point home, each one of your snowflakes needs to understand that when they're sitting at the negotiating table and waiting for us to pick up the tab, that there are causal relationships between all of this stuff. And I don't know whether or not you sat down with Port Districts, for example, and said, gee, when you're putting on six more employees and you're giving magnificent raises, this is the impact. I don't know if you were that granular in talking to these guys. Just going out and saying the sky's falling is one thing, but to say it's going to fall on you in this way based on decisions that you make at your board table might be very informative.
Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, thank you again for that viewpoint. One of the slides I didn't have in this deck is one that we did have in that employer deck that shows as graphically as we could last fall. Okay, two things. One, that shows you how much PERS rates are going to go up in 2017-2019. It's another, I think, $880 million to all of our employers broken out by state, school district, and local governments. So there is that level of granularity. The other reason I went out when I did is every employer got an advisory rate report from our actuary telling them, this is what you're going to look like in 17. So And because of the circumstances with the rate collar, very high confidence that what we tell you the 17 rates are going to be is what you're going to pay. So it was in conjunction to raise that awareness of what each individual employer is facing, while not actually sitting down with the Port Authority and saying,
I just picked them. I'm not picking on ports, and I know there are guys that are listening to this on tapes. Johnson hates ports. I just picked them as a target of opportunity.
So the answer is, again, everybody took it a little differently, but we are, as part of that campaign and continuing, raising awareness of the fact that we are a more and more important drain on public resources.
Yeah, maybe at some point an existential drain. You don't have to respond.
I think Senator Johnson brings up a really interesting point, and as I was listening, Senator, to your point, it does occur to me that our structure in Ways and Means limits our ability to knit those pieces together.
Yes.
And I frankly, at this point, after your very good point, plan to have a conversation with the co-chairs about whether we ought to have a big pull it all together hearing about the impending catastrophic train wreck. Not that we all aren't, especially those of us who lived through the 2013 sessions, acutely aware at some level, but you're right. I mean, we don't have a sense of how, what that parade is going to look like through human services and through education, K-12, and through higher ed. So it may be a very useful thing for us to do as a whole.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Please, you've been very patient with a lot of questions.
Sure.
Have at it.
Okay. So to put this in a broader context, just stepping a little back to a higher level, this is a formula that I started all those employer presentations with, and I generally start any new presentation about PERS with. Understanding this formula and the dynamics of this formula is what helps you resolve any questions you have around the financial status of PERS. So the formula is simple. It's algebra. And so everything on the left side of the equal sign has to equal the stuff on the right side of the equal sign. So benefits has to equal contributions and earnings. And one of the points I make, Representative Comp, back to your comment about benefits, that's in the province of the legislature. And the legislature in 13 did try, for example, to reduce the cost of benefits through the legislation that was passed. And the Supreme Court said not everything that you passed is going to go up to muster.
Yeah.
But regardless of what the B is, it has to be equaled by contributions and earnings. There's no point in having a benefit system that can't pay benefits. So the contributions and earnings are employer contributions and held over member contributions from the times when member monies went into their regular and variable account, and earnings. And the point of this formula as well is to see the dynamic with earnings, that to the extent that earnings are larger or greater than assumption, then contributions can go down, assuming that benefits stay static. And when, as Senator Whitsitt pointed out, earnings are not up to assumption, the only way to rebalance this formula is to raise contributions. So contributions are the swing funder in this. Contributions are the only element of this formula that is fully under the province of the PERS board, and that's why every 2 years they adopt employer contribution rates to bring this formula back into balance over time. So just a reminder that we take a rate cycle when we set employer rates. The rates everyone is paying today were based on the valuation at the end of December 2013. We will close the valuation as of the last calendar year, and we'll generate rates from that will go into effect in 17. Then again, 2 years later, close evaluation. 18 months after that, we will have employer rates that are based on that valuation.
And what's it?
Thank you. I wanted to talk a moment about the caller rate. Go back to 2008 and 2009. 2008, the PERS Trust Fund lost around $18 billion in that debacle. And then in 2009, in your rate caller process, you look back 2 years. So you look back while the market was still steaming. And I'm saying you, but the PERS board actually lowered the employer rates in the face of a huge deficit. I'm wondering now, we in this last year, instead of having a 7.5% or 8% return on investment, you had about 1.9%. Will the same thing occur again when you look at the rates in 17? Will you look back past that and see the market doing well?
Co-Chair Steiner, Harrod, Senator Whitsitt, the answer is no. Rates are going up, and they're going up because of the unfunded liability. The returns less than assumption that you're talking about added to the unfunded liability, instead of $18 billion, which is the unfunded liability, is in at $14 billion with all the court changes and things. The failure to hit the assumed rate in 15 probably added another $3 to $4 billion onto that unfunded actuarial liability. Because of the rate caller, we were already going up the maximum amount in 17-19, maximum again in 19-21, probably maximum again in 21-23. The effects that you're talking about from 15 we'll get played into that trajectory to see how high we go, and we'll have earnings in 16, 17, 18, 19, et cetera, that may counterbalance that. To go back to 2008, and the example you're talking about, the discussion at that time was, again, based on this cycle. We did 2009 rates based on the 2007 valuation, and you're right. We did not take into account a lot of the market drop that happened in 2008 and going into 2009. At that time, we thought that was, we thought that that lowered PERS costs, given the fact that revenue was decreased so much for our government entities, would help balance that out. And we'd catch it up in the next valuation. I don't think anybody foresaw how persistent and how deep that recession was going to be, so that normal cycle where we kind of, we're going to go down a little bit now to come up later when you're coming up, the revenues didn't come up as quickly as we hoped to match that. So, just a little bit of a primer on what the state on what the PERS board looks at when solving that equation and setting employer rates. Just wanted to show you the principles that we follow: transparent and process and inputs. Everything we do is in public. You're all familiar with that. Predictable and stable employer rates would be great if the third bullet was constant, which is protecting the funded status. So the second and third bullets are often in conflict. You want to have predictable rates. If somebody could give me predictable investment returns, I could predict what the rates would be. But because that E is so volatile, rates have to go up. So to protect that funded status, we need to raise rates as prudently as we can. If we lose too much in investments, we start getting wider and wider in that rate collar to make sure we don't have the funded status deteriorate too much. Try to be equitable across generations, and that gets again to this normal cost and unfunded liability rate factor or dynamic that Senator Whitsitt brought out. PERS is predicated on the fact that my contributions pay for my benefits. In other words, when my employer puts money for me into the PERS system, that's to pay for my retirement investments generally, not like Social Security, which is a pay-as-you-go system. All of our contributions to Social Security don't pay for the benefits we enjoy. It's for the people who have already received benefits at Social Security. So The point about generational equity is we try to set contribution rates so that a member's contribution or a contribution related to a member's salary will pay for that member's benefit down the line. Where we are now, of course, having a challenge with that is so much of the legacy cost that has been associated with the unfunded liability. That's being calculated based on the salary of current employees. But Representative Comp, to your point, The large cost for PERS for me is not to pay for my benefit. It's a little bit for that or half for that, but the other more than half is to pay for the benefits of people that have already retired. So, and then just to understand or appreciate how important investments are, this is a PERS dollar since 1974, just to show 74 cents almost of every dollar we have to pay benefits comes out of investment earnings. And 21 cents for employers and then a little bit for members.
Thank you. Senator Smith.
Thank you. I want to go back. Can you go back to your algebraic formula of B equals C plus E?
Yes, sir.
Realistically, the chances that future returns on investment are going to return back to where they were in the 80s isn't going to occur. Let's just pretend. So we know we're going to have a difficult time increasing that. We know we have set benefits that we're contractually obligated to meet. So the question I'm trying to get my arms wrapped around is how do we modify the formula on contribution? Okay. And so I guess I'm trying to solve this. I understand the issue. I really think I understand what's going on here. I'm trying to figure out, are we going to have to ask everyone to double the amount they contribute, employers contribute? Are we going to have to go borrow money? What's the solution? Because if we can't increase our investment earnings, our only other option is to increase our contributions.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Smith, my work here is done. You got it.
And so I, What we as a body have to understand is either we're going to have to go borrow money, a lot of money, or we're going to have to raise double, triple, I don't know what the number is, the amount employers are going to contribute.
This chart tops out at about 30%, even under our assumed rate, our assumed rate. So the clear message is right now rates are around, on average, 17. We're going to 30.
Okay, so let me ask this question. And my background's commercial finance. And so I'm every day managing cash flow. And so at some point, it may be more worthwhile for us to borrow one heck of a lot of money and get on a payment plan than it is to ask our employers to double or triple their contribution annually. Have we analyzed those two scenarios? Not, and I don't mean you directly, but has that conversation occurred?
Co-chair Stenner here with Senator Smith. Representative Smith. The conversations are starting, but I'm not as well versed in what the public finance aspect of then costs of that might be. What you're talking about there, of course, most often is termed as a pension obligation bond. You go out and borrow a whole bunch of money, you give it to the retirement system to invest, and then you have an arbitrage play.
Right.
Uh-huh. Do you earn enough on that investment more than what your bond costs
to finance? You're probably not going to, but at least then you take your unfunded liability and you clean it up.
You do, and so that's one way to resolve your unfunded liability. The other way that we resolve it in this sense is we spread it out over what we think is a prudent amount of time, 20 years, and we spread it out over payroll on a set rate basis, meaning that a level percentage of payroll over time, which is where we get to 30, and then we hold at 30. What this chart doesn't show you, of course, is the next biennium, 2035, 37, the rates go back down to normal cost,
right,
which would be precipitous if this is what the world looks like for the next 20 years.
Right. Yeah.
But it won't. I don't know what it will look like, but it won't look like this.
So just my last thought on this, Madam Coacher, and then I want to keep listening.
Please.
To me, it seems from a cash flow management perspective for the state, we may be better off looking at one of those pension obligation bonds and figuring out how are we going to cash flow this, the state and our partners, to solve this problem and get it behind us, rather than having to take it out of our cash flow every biennium,
yep,
which is going to impact education, public safety, human services, uh-huh, all the way along. While the issue is complex, the financing solution is pretty simple. I'm trying to figure out if I'm wrong on this.
No, I really appreciate you bringing that up, Coacher Smith. I mean, we've got to figure something out because it's going to be catastrophic. I think people in my district were complaining 4 years ago about class size. I can only imagine what they're going to be seeing in 2021.
That's right.
So, Senator Whitsitt.
Yeah, to your co-chair, before we jump into a thought like that, we probably should look very closely at what we've done with ODOT.
Yeah,
We obligated future revenues, and now we don't have any.
Right.
I think there is no good answer.
I just want to make sure.
I think it's out loud. I think it's really important.
So
keep going. Cheer us up some more, Mr. Redmond.
I will. Let me tell you. let me tell you why earnings aren't going to be any better. Just to add to this.
Oh, goodness.
So this is a slide that I'm blatantly stealing from the Oregon Investment Council's general consultant, Callan, because John Sherram, the investment division leader, went to the Callan's conference a couple of weeks ago. He saw this slide, brought it to my PERS board 10 days ago, and it was so good that I thought I would share it with you today. This is a thought exercise which says, given the state of Oregon's assumed rate of 7.5%, if you had woken up 20 years ago with the investment opportunities you had 20 years ago, and we're just going to hit a 7.5% return, what portfolio would you have to construct? And you could have done it all with a fixed income portfolio in 1995. Just that's the circumstances we were under then. So if 20 years ago the OIC had moved everything into fixed income at 7.5%, then we wouldn't have any volatility, and we'd also have a standard deviation or volatility measure of 6%. Roll that again 10 years into the future. In 2005, you wake up, you need to hit 7.5%. You see that we start getting into more diversified investments. You also see how the standard deviation goes up from 6 to 8.9. So lastly, we come to 2015, and this is what a hypothetical portfolio would look like in 2015 to generate an expected return of 7.5%. And you see the broad diversity of investment types that have to be tapped into to reach that 7.5%, but you also see the standard deviation is almost tripled. Mm-hmm. So what this tells you is to get 7.5% today, you're looking at a very volatile mix of investments. And what John Shervin would also tell you is we've gone about as far as we can go. You cannot prudently get much more into the realm of chasing return and trying to get higher than 7.5% given the situation we're looking at today.
Especially just in the general volatility. By the time I stopped listening to the radio this morning, the market was down 390 points. I don't know how it ended.
It came back to 170 down.
You know, we're all happy.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, it's every day is a roller coaster ride. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is another set of slides looking at it a different way. Now you're holding your volatility.
As a curiosity, have you done the math on what that roller coaster is? Down 100 points equals this much off of our portfolio?
Co-chair standing here with Senator Johnson.
Answer after one.
The answer is no, because the diversity in the investments that we have, we only have a certain percentage in public equity.
Okay.
And also, there are the real estate, private equity.
That's
fixed
fair.
Income,
that's fair. That's fair.
Market drivers.
Yeah. Thank you.
This just shows you, and I think Senator Whitsitt, this is something that you're going to relate to, and that is, what if instead of investment return you held the standard deviation constant? In other words, you tried to stay as minimally volatile at that 6% standard deviation. Again, in 2015, if you wanted a 6% standard deviation, you're looking at a 4.8% return on your portfolio rather than the 7.5% return that we have set. So we have a very complicated investment portfolio chasing a 7.5% return, which is a reasonable return compared to other retirement systems as investors. But the cost of that return is the volatility that we see and the standard deviation that we experience.
Senator Whitsitt.
I think your statement, Mr. Rodman, is true regarding public employee retirement systems. I don't think it is true if you extend it to private sector employees.
Can I clarify your question, Senator? You mean that you don't think that the statement on these two slides about
What I'm saying, Madam Chair, is that we're assuming a 7.5% return on investment right now, and so are the other public employee retirement systems. Private sector retirement systems, say Ford or GM or whoever, are closer to the 4.8 or probably less than that.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
They're based on a different assumption.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying your point.
So lastly, Senator Johnson, to your point a little bit about not only volatility matters, but when volatility occurs matters. And this slide just shows you the sequence of returns matters a lot. Both of these funds are basically invested in the same mix of assets. It's just, do you have a lot of good years up front, or do your good years come at the end of the 20 years? And this shows you just how the return could vary over that time, just depending on when the good years fall rather than when the bad years fall.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for that slide. I mean, I've been trying to get that point made for so long. the return on investment after you lost $18 billion was still 7.5% or 8%, but it was 8% on $42 billion, not $68
right.
billion.
This is the point that nobody seems to understand, and it infuriates me. They're like, well, but we've had all these good years. Yeah, but you're building off of a smaller base, and it doesn't matter. You can have the best returns in the world, but if you're building off a much smaller base, it doesn't matter. It doesn't get you back. You can never get that lost money back.
Very instructive slide. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, all of this is very instructive. Thank you.
You're welcome. That was what I was going to present related to the assumed rate. I don't know, Chair Steiner-Hayward, if you want to move into the preliminary earnings crediting or close.
Do we have any other questions about the assumed earnings rate? Because we're in a separate work session on this, right? Yes? Okay. Let's do these one at a time, because you're going to talk about earnings crediting separately.
Okay.
So we've got a work session. Does CFO have recommendations? Okay, LFO recommendations.
LFO, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Great. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you. No, we don't, actually.
Thank you. Do you want me to go out and run the trap line in the hall?
Yeah, would you please? This is what we dealt with last week with DR. Thank you, Senator.
I'm going to get you a little sheepskin cover for your mallet.
I'm kidding, right? Oh, my gosh. Thank you. Okay, we now are back to quorum. Senator Johnson has made a motion to accept LFO's recommendation that we acknowledge receipt of their report on the assumed earnings. Is there further discussion of this motion? Is there objection to this motion? If not, so moved. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to take this to full for us?
Sure.
I'd be grateful. Thank you very much. Okay, I am closing the work session on the Public Employees Retirement System Assumed Earnings Rate Report and opening a work session on the Public Employees Retirement System 2015 Earnings Crediting Report. Mr. Gordon.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is PERS normal statutory report that they come to the legislature each year around this time. And again, the important thing to note are these are preliminary crediting figures that you'll be hearing today, and the final decision will be by the PERS board in late March. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rudman. The floor or the
thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. Members of the committee, again, Steve Roldman with PERS. The preliminary earnings crediting report, this table shows you what the PERS board adopted at their January board meeting on a preliminary basis. The total returns show to be about 1.88% to those funds or accounts that receive earnings on an allocation basis, meaning the benefits and force reserve two member regular accounts and employer reserves. Tier one member regular accounts get the assumed rate. That's what the statute tells us to do. So tier one member regular accounts will get 7.75%, as that was the assumed rate in calendar year 2015. The good news related to that is that the tier one rate guarantee reserve is a reserve that we establish, again, directed by statute, where anytime tier one accounts earn more than the assumed rate, the tier one members still get the assumed rate, and only that, the excess is put into this reserve. So this reserve was funded up over the prior couple of years when we had excess returns above the assumed rate. So there was enough in that reserve to credit to tier one member regular accounts at the assumed rate. And we even still have a little bit of money left over in that reserve. And hopefully returns will turn back around and that reserve will build back up again. Again, according to the statute, if we need to dip this reserve into the negative, then it can only be negative for 5 years, and then we have to resolve that negative balance. So we have a span of time to make up for that deficit, hopefully with excess returns. And again, the good news, at least related to this crediting, is we did not start that deficit situation in this year, so the clock has not started to tick on that.
Okay. Questions about that, folks?
I just have one question.
Please.
Mr. Rudman, is there any investment in that PERS portfolio in precious metals, or is there some reason why it can't be?
co-chair Steiner here with Senator Whitsitt. I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure with $70 billion we're invested in everything in some degree that we're allowed to. We don't have a lot of exposure to commodities and commodity pricing, but I can dig that out through the treasurer's office and get you some detail about that.
Okay. Any other questions? LFO.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd entertain a motion.
Madam Co-Chair, you have a motion here. I move that we move the LFO recommendation and acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves that we acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved. We need a carrier for this.
But I take one, you take one.
Actually, Senator Whitsitt's taking the assumed earnings piece, and you want to take the crediting piece? That'd be great. Thank you. Good. Okay. Anything else? Okay. I'm going to close the work session on the earnings crediting report. Do we have any other business before the committee today?
Anything? How much good news can you stand?
Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you. Mr. Redmond, thank you. If not, we're adjourned. Thank you. Mr. Redmond, thank you for the good of the order. If